I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hi everyone, happy new year. Welcome back to a new season of Blood Ties.
New year.
Middle of January, which I hope is going to be very interesting.
What do you hope is going to be interesting?
Well, I think what we're doing this year will be interesting. Trying to do all sorts of different things.
Yes.
More interviews, more solos.
Geoffrey's in charge.
Yeah, well, sort of. But I think it's started well. I had lots and lots of very interesting emails from the listeners, one of which I'll refer to, not this podcast, but the next one. And this, it's a fascinating time, and I'm so grateful for all the many messages we get. And I do try and reply, but I don't always manage it.
You're still working on Instagram, aren't you? I'm getting there.
We're better, and I'm really picking up the Patreon. I've really taken it on board. Molly's quietly reminded me.
What are you going to do for the Patreon? Lots of videos.
Nice. And reflecting too on more contemporary events.
What was the thing I was reading about this morning about this man who killed two women, and one of them he won't say where she is.
Yes.
And the other one, he put her body in a drum and poured petrol on her and burnt her.
Yes.
They were both escorts.
They were.
That's quite an interesting case to me.
It is. Soon.
Is it too contemporary?
A bit.
Okay.
My danger is always,
I know, doing things that are still in court and stuff.
Prejudicing the trial.
Mm.
And that's the issue.
Yeah.
That's so difficult for all of us. I mean, in the wake of a conviction, you're on safer ground. The difficulty, it comes when it comes to an appeal.
And yeah.
That's always a difficulty.
Yeah. Better to leave it.
But there is a lot of leeway in there, actually, because once the matters are in the public domain, in other words, once they've been discussed at a trial, you're perfectly at liberty to discuss the trial and the conviction. The problem becomes, what if he then appeals? Now, it's widely regarded by the Court of Appeal that reporting the events of a murder trial, especially when there's been a conviction, is perfectly within reason. It's just a question of how much detail you go into. It's one of those. It's a really difficult one. And journalists over the years have struggled with it, because what you don't want is to in any way affect the fairness of a trial. And that's the whole reporting restrictions argument. Because, as you know, every time a jury is instructed, particularly in a murder trial, they're instructed not to read any newspapers and not to listen to the media. Well, that's a little bit far-fetched these days, because it's almost impossible to escape. You've only got to pick up your phone and press news. You've only, you know, whatever.
Do they still do that thing where they put them all, like, in a hotel somewhere?
Oh, well, they do, yes. Sequestered.
Mm.
Yes, they do. But even so, and that's usually only when they're sent away to consider their verdict.
Oh, okay.
Rather than every night.
Every night while they're in the trial.
While they're in the trial. And if you've got a trial which goes on for 8 weeks, it's quite a tough one to be sequestered with a lot of people you don't know for 8 weeks in a hotel room which you don't want to be in.
Yeah.
And you want to go home and see your family.
Yeah, that's pretty grim.
It's a difficult one. So that's where the influence comes in. And the one thing we've always got to be aware of, and I think we are actually, Mo, is that reporting events is always, to some extent, biased. I mean, there is no such thing as a true, absolute true fact. I try and make it clear quite often, in fact, that this was the allegation, but which the jury accepted. Therefore, it must be, quotes, a fact. But we're going to do a case today in which it is fascinating and raises exactly that question.
Okay, cool. So what are we doing today?
We're doing today, it's a fascinating one. It's the case of Edith Thompson. And Edith Thompson was hanged 100 years ago this week.
I was going to say it must be pretty old.
1923.
A new drama about Ruth Ellis, you'll be pleased to hear.
Ah, well, it's a great story, isn't it? We have done it.
We have, yeah.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
Did she mean to kill him? Yes, of course she did. I'm pretty sure she did.
I don't think that's the way the script is skewed.
I wouldn't have thought it was, but that, my conviction is that she was determined to kill him. But it was a core celebrity, along with Bentley and Craig, and along with Christie and Evans. It's one of the cases that turned Britain against the death penalty. She was the last woman to hang, as we've said. So that is interesting. Yeah.
So Edith?
Thompson.
Thompson. And what are we calling it?
We're calling it... She died for a crime she didn't do.
She died for a crime she didn't do?
That's right.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
There we go. She died for a crime she didn't do.
Edith Thompson was born very close to where you live, Moll, in Dalston, in London, in December, Christmas Day, 1893. Her father was a man...
And I was born in 1983.
That's right. Her father, William Graydon, was a clerk at the Imperial Tobacco Company. She was the oldest of five children. She was bright, clever, good at dancing, very good at sums, as they were called, before they called it arithmetic and then mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And after leaving school, she joined a clothing firm in 1911. She left school in 1909. But in 1911, she joined a milliner's, wholesale milliner's, called Carlton and Pryor. She was stylish, she was intelligent, and she rapidly became chief buyer, regularly making trips to Paris. I mean, it's pretty...
Very nice.
Pretty nice life, you know. And she was, well, she was a very sparky lady. At 1909, at the age of 15, before she left school, she met a man called Percy Thompson, who was 18. And after 6 years of an engagement, they finally married in January 1916. At first, they lived in Westcliff-on-Sea, but then later bought a house in Ilford, 41 Kensington Gardens. Quite a nice, comfortable house, like the Villa Madeira that Alma Rattenbury had in Bournemouth. Now, Edith earned a lot more than her husband. And he was, to put it politely, on the dull side. He was rather conventional and didn't really fit in with this incredibly vibrant woman. Anyway, in 1920, she and her younger sister, Avis, go on holiday with Percy, her husband, and a friend of Avis's called Frederick Bywaters, who, funnily enough, Edith had known quite a long time because he was at school with one of her younger brothers. He was 8 years younger. She was 29, he was 20. There was an instant attraction. Frederick was handsome, impulsive. He'd been round the world. He was in the Merchant Navy. He had rather a sort of, a bit of a swagger about him. And, well, not surprisingly, the affair began on the holiday to the Isle of Wight. Percy didn't notice anything. Percy was oblivious. But it became really quite intense. So much so that Percy, for whom I have some sympathy, invited Frederick Bywaters to stay in the house in Ilford with them, with Edith and he, while he was not at sea. Well, that perhaps wasn't the wisest of moves. But eventually, in 1921, Percy realised that this affair had been going on, and he hit Edith. Bywaters saw this and reproached him, underlining to Percy that he'd been right all along. So Percy throws Bywaters out of the house. Off you go. Don't darken my doorstep again. Bywaters goes back to sea. Well, he'd been at sea before. It was a nice thing. Edith is consumed by love. She writes him love letter after love letter after love letter and asks him to destroy every letter once he's read them. She's rather, for the times, quite outspoken. She describes sexual experiment and satisfaction. She describes all manner of female qualities which were not spoken about in the early 20s. Bywaters doesn't destroy the letters, some of which refer to her despair at Percy and wishing that he was dead. And she'd like to poison him. And she was going to grind up glass and put it in his mashed potato. Well, not hugely likely, but never mind. Nevertheless, Bywaters, remember, much younger than Percy and indeed Edith, returns from the sea and decides to kill Percy. Well, did he decide to kill him or did he decide to confront him? It's actually quite interesting because when we get to the actual death, we'll see why. But did he tell Edith what his plans were? The answer is no. So, on the 3rd of October 1922, Percy and Edith go to a show in London at the Criterion Theatre. They get the central line, the new central line, back to Liverpool Street to get the train to Ilford. Avis, her younger sister, was to have joined them, but at the last minute decided not to. They're walking back from Ilford Station to the house in Kensington Gardens when they get to Belgrave Road. Very upmarket road names for Ilford. But it was very much a coming suburb in those days. It was, of course, in Essex. All of a sudden, a man jumps out of the bushes. There were bushes in Belgrave Road. And attacks Percy, stabbing him four times, once in the neck. Edith was knocked to the ground and Percy had effectively died before she got up. But she was heard and said to have shouted, oh don't, several times. She was distraught, very distressed and hysterical. Well, it was quite clear, certainly from her sister, that Edith's relationship with Bywaters was quite close. And Bywaters was arrested the following day, on the 4th of October, 1922. And Edith was initially told that he'd confessed to the murder. He hadn't at that point. But we were bending the rules slightly. But then Edith, keen to get it off her chest, so to speak, confessed that they knew each other, that she knew Bywaters well, that there'd been an association, that he had at one point lived with them, and then Percy had thrown him out of the house. When the police searched Bywaters' cabin on his merchant ship, they discovered 60 love letters locked in a box. Those love letters were to form the basis of the case against Edith Thompson.
What for? Conspiracy.
But hang on. They were taken as evidence that, and this is putting two and two together and getting five, that she had incited Bywaters to kill her husband so that she could resume her affair with him.
Okay? Yeah.
What was even more outrageous to the police, and eventually indeed to the judge, was the, how can one put it, the frank nature of the letters. They were outspoken and most unladylike for 1922. Her defence originally argued when the case was going to the magistrate, that the letters did not prove any kind of common purpose. There was no underlying saying, you will meet him at Belgrave Road. There was nothing of that. It was simply the association of her clear attraction for Bywaters and the fact that Percy was dull and she was a bit fed up with him. The magistrate decided that the love letters were evidence, and indeed both Edith and Frederick Bywaters were charged with Percy's murder. Very little time elapsed before the trial at the Old Bailey. It began on the 6th of December 1922, barely 2 months after the killing of Percy. Both were in the dock together. They weren't given separate trials, they were given the same trial. Bywaters, to his eternal credit, collaborated with the police, led them to where he'd hidden the murder weapon, which was a knife, dagger, and insisted to the police that Edith knew nothing whatever about his plan to kill Percy. Nothing. But 27 of the 60 letters, which dated from November 1921 to September 1922, were read to the court, in which she remarks that she'd like to feed him ground glass in mashed potato and poison him, and evidence that she was, if you like, a scarlet woman. She'd also admitted that she'd had an abortion after becoming pregnant by Bywaters. For his part, Bywaters insisted that he hadn't meant to kill Percy, merely to frighten him to allow Edith to get a divorce, which, again, not exactly commonplace in 1923. And that she knew, Bywaters told the court, in terms, that she knew nothing whatever about his tongue, and that when Percy had, you know, in a sense told him, don't be so silly, he lost his temper and stabbed him. The judge gave a summing up to the jury, which could best be described as not entirely without bias. He described the letters as nauseous. Nauseous is hardly strong enough to describe their contents, he told the jury, whom he insisted on referring to as gentlemen, although there were two ladies on it. On the 11th of December 1922, just 5 days after the trial had begun at the Central Criminal Court, the Old Bailey, both Edith and Frederick Bywaters were found guilty, and both were sentenced to hang. Bywaters, at the trial, as the verdict was returned, Bywaters addresses the court and says, "I say the verdict of the jury is wrong. Edith Thompson is not guilty." In spite of being painted a scarlet woman by the love letters, almost a million people signed a petition against the death sentences. An astonishing number.
That's a lot.
Bywaters attracted incredible admiration for his protestations and his protectiveness towards her. Thompson was seen by some as the controlling influence, the evil force in the relationship. No woman had actually been hanged in Britain since 1907. 20 women convicted of murder had been reprieved. But the Home Secretary of the day decided that she was such a outrageous scarlet woman that he was not going to reprieve her.
I know why you've done this case now.
I've got nothing up my sleeve, I promise. Edith was, of course, in Holloway, where she had to be almost constantly sedated. She was so upset. When she heard that she wasn't going to be reprieved, I mean, she virtually went into complete breakdown, shock. She was simply in a state of complete collapse. On the 9th of January, 2023, still heavily sedated, she was tied hand and foot.
1923.
She was tied hand and foot and carried to the gallows by four female warders.
Come on. We can do better than this.
The two, Bywaters and Edith Thompson, were hanged, he in Pentonville and she in Holloway, within half a mile of each other, at exactly the same time, 9 a.m. on the 9th of January, 1923. It is a legend in its own right, and it is exactly 100 years ago. The judge's comments to this day arouse outrage. Sir Montague Shearman, Mr. Justice Shearman, clearly misdirected the jury into suggesting that Edith had lured Percy to the killing. You know, he'd made sure that he walked down Belgrave Road, based on absolutely no evidence whatever. But the Court of Appeal did not overturn Shearman or the verdict or the killing. The newspapers were horrified. The Daily Express in particular commented, "Let's not mix the crime of murder with the sin of adultery." Edgar Luscon, a famous commentator on legal affairs, was to comment later in 1949, "It was a failure of inhuman understanding." Edgar Wallace, the writer, refused to go to the trial for the Evening News, who he worked for a lot of the time. He said, "I don't want to see an innocent woman condemned." They were convinced that Edith was going to be convinced. Since then, in that 100 years, a number of people have been pardoned. We've talked about Derek Bentley, who was pardoned, who didn't. He may have said, "Let him have it, Chris," but he didn't kill the policeman. Alan Turing, the codebreaker, was posthumously pardoned.
There's not much good if it happens after death.
No, I agree with that. Bentley. Well, nevertheless, it means a lot to the survivors of Edith Thompson's family.
Yeah, sorry, I don't mean to undermine that.
The Home Office has this week announced that it's reconsidering the Justice Secretary's decision not to reopen the case. And I suspect that what we'll see is the whole case referred to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. One of the people who has campaigned strenuously and very vigorously for a very, very long time that Edith Thompson was unfairly treated and wrongly hanged is Professor René Weiss of University College London. And he has helped to set up what is really an excellent website about the case, about her, about the misdirected jury, about her trial. It's called Edith Jessie Thompson, if you want to look it up. And it's really very good indeed. So she went to the gallows for a crime that she did not commit.
Because of the patriarchy.
And it raises again the same question that we've talked about so many times. Surely, surely, it's an argument against the death penalty. To hang a woman who is clearly...
I mean, what that is, Geoffrey, is an argument against men being in charge of everything.
Okay, well, I'll take that.
In my opinion. Because they're just making an example of her.
Yes, they were.
Because of what she wrote in the letters, mainly, I imagine.
It's entirely because
I don't want anyone to think it's okay to behave like that when she was just like being a woman or a human being.
I actually completely agree with her innocence. All she was ahead of her time.
Well, not. She was just... Is it ahead of her time, or is it just what women have always thought but haven't been allowed to say?
I don't know. That's something only you could answer. Really?
Well, it's just... I just think it's not ahead of her time. She was just being herself.
She was just being herself, yes.
It's just everyone else, men, decided that wasn't appropriate.
Particularly the policemen and the criminal justice system.
Yeah, all men.
All men. She was defended, of course, by a man. The jury were 10 men, 2 women. And it took them very little time indeed to convict her.
Yeah.
I think it is a spectacular miscarriage of justice.
Big time.
And utterly wrong.
Hopefully she gets pardoned too.
Well, I think it would make a difference. There are relatives, surviving relatives. Of the four, of her siblings. Of her four siblings.
Poor old Edith.
Yes. And the crime she committed was to fall in love with a man who was 8 years younger than she was, and to complain in her love letters that she got a bit bored with Percy.
I mean, that's not much, really, is it?
It's not really.
Not in comparison to some of the other stuff we've talked about on these podcasts over the years.
No, it really
isn't. Small fry.
Small fry. But I do think it's an absolutely wonderful case.
Interesting.
And it's... The fact that it's 100th anniversary only makes it even more interesting for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And that it's at the Old Bailey and that they're potentially reopening it.
Yes, and that the Home Office are now reconsidering.
Mm.
It should go to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. It absolutely stands no way. The Justice Secretary's reasoning for not recommending a pardon was that no new evidence had been presented.
There wasn't any evidence in the first place. How could there be new evidence when there was never any evidence?
Quite.
What an idiot.
Well, that was the reason he gave, his official reason.
Well, he's officially an idiot then.
Yeah, well, there you go. So that is the case of Edith Thompson.
The woman committed for a crime she didn't do.
That's right. Hanged for a crime she
didn't do. The woman hanged for a crime she didn't do.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dad.
Pleasure. Did you have a good Christmas and New Year?
Yeah, it was fine.
Good.
Fine.
Yes.
Really low key. How was yours?
Mine was okay. Thank you. Low key, like yours.
Good.
And what's it like being back at work? Just the same.
Like coming back to work from a holiday.
Oh, right.
The same as it was before.
Okay.
As if you never left, sort of thing.
As if you never left. As if you were never away.
Yeah. It's the same.
I think it's great.
Which part?
Well, I get edgy if I'm not working.
Yeah, we all know this.
I get restless if I haven't got something to do, you know.
Yeah, I know.
That's why I was pleased to get back to doing this, you know. Back to looking at cases I didn't know.
Yes, I know.
It's really, for me, it's wonderful.
Yeah, good.
So we should maybe remind everyone how they contact us.
Well, I personally think probably the best way to contact us is just through Jeffrey's website.
Yeah.
Because I am not checking the other things as much anymore. But Dad does look at Instagram, so if you want to...
I do.
Go to bloodties_pod. On Instagram and message him. Jeffrey will reply to you. It just takes a minute sometimes. Otherwise, if you go to his website, you can find his email address on there.
Yes, if you Google me, you'll get
just
mine.
Just Google him, yeah. He's very Googleable.
Yeah, and that also gives you how to contact me.
But yes, we do have bloodties.podcast@gmail.com, but I don't check it as often as I should do.
Okay. Well, I could start doing that.
You can, yeah. You can. I can give you the login and things.
Teach me how to do it.
Yeah, so that's that. Well, thank you, Dad. That was really interesting. And thank you to all the people that help us. Our producer, Sam Brain, my brother, Dan, who did the music, my friend, George, who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Jeffrey for all of his hard work, and to you, the listeners. We're very pleased to be back, and thank you so much for sticking with us.
Thank you so much. It's much appreciated, really. It's a privilege to broadcast to you. And thank you for all your missives and communications. And if I'm a bit slow, please forgive me, but I will get there in the end. And as I often say, it's also due to Molly. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. So,
I mean, you'd be alive.
Well, but I wouldn't be on this podcast, as it was your idea. So, as I always say at the end of these podcasts, bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.